welcome everybody. This evening we begin tape number 11. One of the problems that becomes an obstacle for a child that is rebellious or wayward is the system of authority and education that exists in our community. Now, we're not going to blame anybody for this yet, but the fact is, if you have a child that's perhaps a bad influence on other students, the chances are that the yeshiva he's in is going to throw him out. Once a yeshiva throws a student out, it's much more difficult for him to get into another yeshiva. Because of this, there are a number of former yeshiva students and Beis Yaakov students that are now attending public school or attending no school at all. And nowadays, that's frightening, because if this child was a bad influence and had problems when they were in Yeshiva or Beis Yaakov, you can just imagine how much those problems are compounded by the fact that they're now in public school. It's almost a death sentence. The Rosh Yeshiva of Yitzchak Kutner once said that in the olden days, a yeshiva used to be like the Mishkan. The Mishkan was a place where Hashem's Shechina resided, V'yasuli Mikdash V'shachanti B'soicham. It was a place where you were able to serve HaKadosh Baruch Hu in a very special way. But outside the walls of the Mishkan was also a place where you could serve Hashem. The Mishkan's atmosphere elevated the person and brought him to higher levels. Nowadays, he said, the yeshiva is not like a Mishkan, but rather like the Teva of Noach, which was nothing special in and of itself. It was just a wooden structure that floated on the water. It wasn't fancy and it didn't have any special kedusha or any special status. But what it did was, it protected everybody from the marble outside. You were either in the teva or you were dead, one of the two. And so nowadays, a yeshiva is actually a shelter from the marble, from the flood of anti-Torah attitudes, from the flood of apikursis, and the flood of kefira, and the flood of bad influences, the flood of taivas, and the flood of yetzaharas that's taking place outside the yeshiva. A similar sentiment is expressed by the Stifler Zatzal in his Sefer Birkas Peretz and Parshas Vayetze. But there's no question about it that nowadays a yeshiva is a shelter from a flood that would just sweep everybody away if not for the fact that we have it. Therefore, for a bachur or a girl to leave the yeshiva or the Beis Yaakov, it's like making them walk the plank. Now, we discussed this once before, and al pi halacha, and according to the direction of the great gedolim of the last generation, a yeshiva is often justified in expelling a bachur or a girl, particularly if that student is having an adverse influence on others. Fine. So the yeshiva had a right to do what they did, and even an obligation to do what they did. Because that's the fact. And if your child was not the bad influence, but rather the child sitting in the seat that was the victim or the target of the bad influence, you would have something to say if that yeshiva would maintain that student in its student roster. Fine. But now what does the Yiddish and Neshama do? That Jewish soul who was the bad influence on others, that kid that's having problems, who now finds himself outside Noach's table in the marble, what does he do now? We unfortunately do not have, we do not possess facilities to deal with such cases yet. We do not possess a safety net for those kids that fell through the cracks. There are many suggestions that people have regarding what to do about this problem. And not all the suggestions are realistic. One of the suggestions that I've heard a lot is that we should make a special yeshiva for these type of kids. It won't work. Because it won't be yeshiva, it'll be a circus. One of the great principles of dealing with our rebellious youths is that we have to try as much as possible to separate them from their friends, off of whom they feed, and from whom they receive chizuk, with whom they form their little subculture where they support each other and make each other worse. And so a yeshiva designed for rebellious teenagers would be probably a greater mikshol than it would be an assistance for them. The fact is that we have to create a system outside of our yeshivas for these children. And that's what it says in the Gemara. The Gemara says about a Talmud she'enoi hogoin, means an undesirable student. Now this Talmud she'enoi hogoin is still Jewish, still a Yiddish and a Shama, and it doesn't necessarily mean that the person is Mechalel Shabbos. Talmud she'enoi hogoin, whatever is deemed an undesirable student, says the Gemara, Machzirin oisei lemutav, first we straighten him out, we return him to the right path, v'yachakach, and afterwards, machnisin oisei lebeis hamedrash, and afterwards, we admit him into the yeshiva. Now, it's clear from the Gemara that there are facilities, or there should be facilities, or at least the capacity, or the capability of straightening somebody out outside of the four walls of the yeshiva. And that doesn't exist nowadays, and it should. There's absolutely no reason it shouldn't. And we're going to see in a moment why it doesn't exist, and what we can do about it. But the fact is that this is just one reason why our system, the way our community is set up, is really an obstacle for the recovery of our wayward youth. If we were able to redo our social structure and our educational structure, it would be a lot easier for our children with problems to find their way back to the straight path. Now, I'm not saying that it's anybody's fault or anybody's to blame or anybody did anything wrong in setting up this structure. When Torah was planted in America, Rabban Kotler consistently reiterated that the goal of the yeshivas should be to produce Gedolei Yisrael, and nobody ever thought that Rabban would be so correct and so accurate in his foresight when he made his prediction that Torah would be replanted in America only through the method of Torah Lishma. But here we are, 40, 50 years after World War II, and Torah is planted in America. The only problem is that every generation has its problems, and we have to deal with it as it comes. This is a new problem, and this is something new. We have to adjust, we have to shift, we have to be flexible and deal with this. This never was a problem before. Now it is. We have to adjust our system to be able to include a place for these children. Now, a lot of people blame this mistakenly on our Rosh Yeshiva, on our Gedolim, or on our Rabbonim. Why aren't they doing anything for these kids? Why isn't anybody doing anything? Why is nobody running to save these Yiddish neshamas? Truth of the matter is that every single Rosh Hashiva and every single Adam Gadol that exists on this planet wants desperately to do something to help these children. The problem is not there. I know. I have approached a number of these Rosh Hashivas, including Rav Shach, Zolzayin Gesund, with various different ideas about dealing with the problem of these children. The problem, I mean a communal problem. And every single one of them have been forthcoming. The problem is, that we live in Ikvus of the Mashiach, and our Rosh Yeshiva cannot do anything unless people are going to listen. There's a Gemara in Masechet Sota that says that before Mashiach comes, during that time period that's called Ikvus of the Mashiach, that time period of right before Mashiach's arrival, that generation is described as Pnei Hador Kipnei Akelev. The face of the generation will be like the face of the dog, meaning that the generation will be similar to a dog. So what does this mean? But Yisrael Salanter explained. He said, you see a person walking a dog in the street. Now, the owner is holding the leash in back of the dog. And the dog is in front of the owner, and they're walking together. To an uneducated or an uninitiated observer, it would appear that the dog is the leader and the man is the follower. Because after all, the dog is in the front and the owner is in the back. But the truth of the matter is that the owner in the back gives a pull on the leash to the right and the dog responds. He gives a pull on the leash to the left and the dog moves. And although it appears that the person in the front is leading, the truth of the matter is it's the guy in the back seat that's driving. So too, said Rabbi Yisrael Salanter, will be our generation, the generation of Ikvus of the Mashiach. That it will appear as if the leaders are really leading. But it's not they that have control. It's going to be the backseat drivers, the hamainam in the street, the average Joes that comprise the populace that are really going to be in control. Ad kan, the words of Rabbi Yisrael Salanter. And we know our Gedolim. And nobody would accuse these great tzaddikim, these great Rosh Yeshivas, of being marionettes to be pulled on strings. And that's not what Rabbi Yisrael Salanter meant. The fact is that nobody, no God will ever have power if the people are just unwilling to listen. I know, I heard once from a mashgiach in the yeshiva where I went, an explanation, how come we don't have a Beis HaMikdash nowadays? He says, let's say we have a Beis HaMikdash in Eretz Yisrael. Some Jews would come as tourists to Eretz Yisrael with the shorts and the undershorts and the cameras around their necks and walk into the Beis HaMikdash, and as the Kohen Gadol is shechting the carbon, they point the camera and say, hold it a minute. It's a bazillion. In order to protect the Beis HaMikdash from the bazillion, and that's just one example, of course, of what we're talking about of a bazillion, HaKadosh Baruch Hu takes it away from us. And the Mashgiach said that this applies also to why we don't have people like the Chafetz Chaim anymore. The Chafetz Chaim would be here. You think people would listen to him more than they listen to our Gedolim today? Absolutely not. It would be a bazillion for the covenant of the Torah to have the Chafetz Chaim banging his head against the wall, trying to convince us to do things, and nobody listens. So we don't have him. People don't listen. When the Gedolim say that we have to do something, that we have to learn Gemara a certain way, faster, whatever, think anybody listens? Nobody listens. And that's an indictment of the generation, not of the Gedolim. And the same thing over here. I want to tell you that a certain yeshiva here in the neighborhood, one of the big yeshivas, wanted to make a resource room for our brothers that need such a facility. It was the Rosh Yeshiva and the Rebbeim that had this idea. The board of directors refused. They said, we can't support such a move, because if we do, people will start saying that the Bacharim and our yeshiva need a resource room. And the other yeshivas that don't have it, they don't need it. So there's a problem with our Bacharim. The truth of the matter is, you know what? People will say that. And the yeshiva will suffer. And now the question is the yeshiva obligated to suffer? To lower its standards? To lose its quality? And sacrifice in order to make the resource room? Well, that's the decision for the Rosh Yeshiva. But if the Rosh Yeshiva decides, no, he can't do it, because even if he wanted to do it, he wouldn't have the support of the board of directors. We may ain kemach ain Torah. Or maybe he decided that it's taka, not appropriate to do it, being that the entire yeshiva would suffer. Tell me who's in control. It's not the Rosh Yeshiva, and it's not the board of directors. The people in control are those Balei Lashon Hara, those shaitim in the street that would run around saying this about the yeshiva. And what about the fact that we know that one of the reasons, one of the many reasons why we don't have yeshivas for such children is because if we would, parents would not want to send their children there even if they need it, because they don't want their children branded as problems. I have a friend who started a yeshiva recently, and he wanted to make a yeshiva not for the Aleph students, he wanted to make a yeshiva for the Beis students. For the Beis and Beis Minor students, for the average yeshiva bacha. And the average yeshiva bacha would have a yeshiva designed for him. His father, who's a very experienced Rosh Yeshiva, told his son that he shouldn't dare try that. Because if he does, he won't get the Beis students, he'll get the Gimels and Dalids, and he'll get the problems, which he's not equipped to handle. That wasn't his idea. Because nobody wants to send their children to a yeshiva that's made for anything except what the mainstream yeshivas are made for. because people will start saying things about this. Yeah, why is he in this yeshiva? Why can't he survive in a regular yeshiva? And what's going to be with shidduchim? And the truth is, people will say that. And because people will say that, that's why parents won't send their kids to such yeshivas. And because parents won't send their kids to such yeshivas, that's why we don't have them. One of the reasons. Last week, I was discussing with the Balabas, also here in the neighborhood, about making a parlor meeting for Project Rejuvenation. He's a very wonderful Bal Tzedakah, this man, and he called me on the phone. He says, you know, he says, my wife has a good taina. He says, my wife says that if I do this for the people in the community, people will start saying, why does this and this guy, why do I have to do with Project Rejuvenation? Must be he has a kid that had a problem. And our kids are starting to do shidduchim now. You never know what people will say. And the truth of the matter is, people will say. And it's a sad state of affairs, but people will say. Avraham Hashem, he's going to do it anyway. But people will say, who's in control? The Hamaynam has the system by the throat. I was speaking with a Menahel today of the yeshiva. It's a yeshiva for a yeshiva for kids mostly from non-film homes. And the yeshiva isn't as successful as it would like to be in terms of giving the students, imparting within them, a love for Yiddishkeit. They come into the school, 9th grade, they go out in 12th grade, they get their 80s and their 90s, whatever, but they remain the same in terms of frumkeit. A lot more than the school would wish. And the Menahel asked me what I think he can do to change that. And I told him that he has to redo his whole curriculum. Gemara and Navi and Chumash Rashi and Mefarshim, this is all great things. But that's not what these students need. These students need basic Yiddishkeit. The type of stuff that you hear on Rabbi Yitzchak Kirzner's tapes, the type of stuff that you read in Rabbi Avigdor Miller's books. This type of stuff should be the meat and potatoes of your curriculum. That's what I told him. He said, yeah, Rabbi Shapiro, you're right, but there's a problem. Because the other yeshivas that he competes with all have Gemara and Chumash and this, and what's going to be when people ask the kids in his school, what do you learn? In this school, they learn Gemara and Chumash, and you're learning this stuff. It must be a lower level school. And all of a sudden, his clientele will end up going elsewhere, because he will have positioned himself in the eyes of the Hamaynam as a lower level school. In other words, if he does what's right for his students, his school will suffer, and his students will suffer. I remember I was teaching a 9th grade Navi class for girls, and on the curriculum we had to finish 2 Sfarim in Navi during the year, Yeshua and Melachim Beis. Now, that's a very fast pace, and I asked the principal if she really thinks that this is what the girls need most. All these ideas, which are very, very wonderful for them to have, all this information, as opposed to going slower and emphasizing the things that are relevant to them more, the hashkafas. And the principal told me, you know what, in the other school, that was their competition, they do 2 Sfarim in the 9th grade. And if we don't have it here, the parents will send the kids there. And the truth is, the parents will send their kids there. And this is a school I know that barely had 2 parallel classes. And if a group of 3 or 4 girls go to a different school, it gets knocked down to 1 class. And that's what happens to be. Not because they kept the curriculum, but because of a certain move that this school made, 3 or 4 girls went to a different school from the 8th grade to 9th grade elsewhere, and for the first time they had to knock down 2 parallel classes, which were approximately 17 or 18 kids in a class, to 1 class in the 9th grade for 28 and 29 kids. So what happened? Because the school decided to do what it felt was right and best for the students, now the school suffered. It got a class got knocked out, and where a girl would be in a class of 16, now she's in a class of 29. For what? Because the school wanted to do what's right. I told her, a Rebbe today, there was a Rebbe in a certain high school, and this high school suddenly finds itself that it has very keen competition, because another school opened up that has targeted the exact same community, the exact same clientele. And the Rebbe in the previous yeshiva, the already established yeshiva, said that they're going to up their standards and they're going to change the yeshiva in order to be able to maintain their clientele. And I told him, Rabbi so-and-so, watch out. If you do all the right things in the yeshiva, no one will come. Watch out. Watch out. And that's the world we live in. We live in a world that's controlled to a large extent by the Hamoin. People give money to what they want to give money to. People send their children to the yeshiva that they consider best, but do they really know? What standards are parents using when they judge yeshivas and schools? That now a yeshiva can say, send your daughter to my school because we have a big fancy swimming pool. Now, a swimming pool is wonderful. But how many parents make their decision based on that? There are ways to decide which school to send your child to. This is not top of the list. But to a lot of parents that I've spoken to, it is. It's not top on the list, second or third. And so what happens? What if a school wants to maintain their status in the community? You gotta have a swimming pool. And what happened to the yeshiva dinners? Nowadays, if a yeshiva makes a dinner and they give out Gucci umbrellas to the women for gifts, so they draw a much larger crowd and they make much more money for the yeshiva. And everybody in Chinuch knows, everybody in an administrative level in yeshiva knows, that if you make a fancy dinner, they call it balabatish, but it means a fancy, gaudy, extravagant dinner or an affair, you make more money for the yeshiva. Now, should this be that way? No, but you know what? The yeshivas have to do it because that's how they make their money. It's not the yeshiva's fault. So who's in control over here? Who's in control? That's Pnei Hador k'Pnei HaKelev. Chas v'Shalom, you don't have to say that our great Gedolim are chalila marionettes. They're not. Rabbi Yisrael Salanter's Vort is alive and living and vital in our generation. Because the fact is that those little yentas in the street that talk about Yenim and the kid about the shidduch are controlling what that family does, because the family does need a shidduch, and that family has a certain amount of power in the community because they're not the only one, they're one of hundreds in the community, and therefore the yeshivas who need the parents and need the balabatim to give money have to be able to satisfy those parents and satisfy the balabatim, and everybody acts accordingly. But who's satisfying whom? It's the people on the top that have to satisfy the people on the bottom, because we need the people on the bottom in order to survive. That is the structure of our community, unfortunately, and it's the fault of the people on the bottom, because the people on the bottom who are needed and who do have power are not using that power the way they should. The bottom line lesson is this. We live now in a Chesed Mashiach. And as members of the Hamoinam, because it's the Kfisa of the Mashiach, we have all been vested with a certain amount of power, because Pnei Hador Kipnei Akelev. And we have to use that power correctly. We can do so many great things. It's not a question like nobody else is doing. What I brought you here tonight to tell you is that everybody in this room can do something. But why doesn't somebody else do? Ask yourself that question first. Because nowadays, you'd be surprised what you can do. It's like the story, you know, the story where there was a shul that was very poor. Had a very poor group of Balabatim, and they didn't have enough money to afford schnapps every week for Kiddush. In fact, they didn't have enough money to afford schnapps even on Simchas Torah for Kiddush. But how could a shul not have a Kiddush on Simchas Torah? So what they did was, they decided that when everybody goes home to make Kiddush for their family, that little drop of schnapps that's left in the glass that normally goes on the garbage should be brought back to shul and placed in a barrel. And at the end of a year, when everybody does this, they'll have a barrel of schnapps. It was a good idea. And there's this one balabas that didn't want to do it. He wanted to drink that last drop. So what he did was, he figured that he can't just not come to shul after the Suda and contribute to the barrel. Everybody will notice that. Everybody will notice that he's not coming. So he's going to like take a drop of water in the cup and just dump it in the barrel, and it won't be noticed because everybody else has all the schnapps, and at the end of the year, what's his few ounces of water going to make a difference? Comes some Chastaya, and we're all ready for Kiddush, and they open up the barrel, and they pour out from the spigot, and lo and behold, it's all water. Everybody had that idea. Everybody wanted everybody else to do the work except them. And what happened? Nobody did anything. And that's the way it works. We have a system. And the system has to be adjusted. It has to be enhanced. It has to be able to meet the needs, the constantly changing needs of our generation. And every Rosh Hashiva and every gadol on this planet is there with you. Every person of authority understands this. The problem is the Hamaynam. I know that there are many people in this room, and there are many, many more people that I know not in this room, that have had to deal with their children within the system, with yeshivas, with social service agencies, with shidduchim. And they've made the tremendous error of thinking that those people that are leading us have turned their backs on them. That's very not true. The people that have turned their backs on the needs of the generation are the Hamanam in the street. Now, first things first, as I said, if you want a big schus, you want a big schus, you do something whatever you can. And you can. For your own children, for your neighbor's children, things can be done. It's not the topic of tonight's lecture about what can be done. But if you want, I'll speak to you privately. Things can be done by every single individual. And eventually, another 5 years down the road, another 10 years down the road, Chalila, another 20 years down the road, this is already going to be part of the mainstream. It's inevitable. The only question is how rapidly we can bring about this turn of events. That is inevitable. That will happen. Because if we don't face it, it's going to just slap us in the face. It's going to slam us in the face. But what I did bring you here tonight to speak about is how, for the sake of your own children, you have to buck the system. Meaning, you have to turn your back on the Hamaynam and not let them control you. Case in point. Father, Big Rav, Big Ben Taira, Big Rosh Hashiva, Balabas, who's a Ben Taira, let's say. A chash of a mensch. And he looks like a chash of a mensch. And he walks like a chash of a mensch. And he talks like a chash of a mensch. Son, who is anything but. He's a rebellious young man, and perhaps even he feels in the shadow of his father. I'm giving a very simplified scenario. The problem is the father's ashamed of this son. And that kills the son. The father's ashamed of him. What does a father being ashamed of a son mean? That means when the father walks outside with the son, he's willing to hurt the son by letting him know how humiliated he is in his presence. Rather than ignore the stares of the strangers and the neighbors and the friends and the acquaintances as he walks down the street. I think I mentioned over here the story of a Rebbe in the yeshiva who had a son who was unfortunately rebellious. And there was another Rebbe in the same yeshiva who said to his friend with the rebellious son, you know, when your son was in my class, we had a very good relationship. Maybe if I speak to him, I could make some headway. So the Rebbe says to his friend, you know, it's a good idea, but one thing, do me a favor, when you speak to him, don't speak to him around yeshiva. Because he didn't want anybody to see, even though everybody knew, but he didn't want anybody to see, or the bachurim in yeshiva to see his son, because he was so embarrassed. And the Rebbe said to his friend, the father of the rebellious son, he said, that's the problem. He said, that's the problem. Children need to know that their father's on their side. And that who cares what other people are looking, how they're looking, and what they're whispering. What's more important to you as a father? That's the question that these children have. Now, of course it's painful. The Gemara says that Tabus Rav B'toich Beisei Shel Adam, a rebellious child in a home, is more traumatic than Milchemas Gog and Magog, than the war of Gog against Magog. There's no question about it. But the bottom line is, Tati, are you ashamed of me because of your friends? Are you still going to treat me like a son despite the snickers that your friends are going to give you? Who do you put ahead of whom? The truth is they will snicker. And the shaitan in the street will talk. And it is painful, it is embarrassing. But you shouldn't let yourself be controlled by the people in the gutter. You shouldn't let yourself be controlled by the snickers in the street. There are so many people that are controlled by the snickers in the street, by the Hamaynam in the gutter, It's Pnei Hador ki Pnei Akelev. The people in the street have power. It's unfortunate. But you know what? You have to be an exception to the rule. There are parents I know who have thrown their children out of the home because if they keep them in the home, it'll be bad for Shidduchim, for the sister. Now the truth of the matter is, unfortunately, Lida, Bavai Niseinu Harabim, it will be bad for Shidduchim, for the sister. And if they throw the kid out, it's out of sight, out of mind. And it may be better for Shidduchim, for the sister. But before you make that decision, you have to understand what you're doing. You're allowing the people in the street to control whether your son lives or doesn't. The daughter will get a shidduch. Life is rough. And when it says that that a rebellious child in a home is more traumatic than the war between Gog and Magog, this is part of it. But what right does anybody have to send a Jewish child out onto the street where it's inevitable that he's going to go straight off the derech? No one has a right to do that. Certainly not because of some social problem. If he's ruining the other children, we ask a shayla to a big gadol. But if it's a social problem, what are we talking about? Where are our values? Who is controlling us? Isn't it a bizarre to us that we're controlled by everybody else? There's a system out there, and we're just buying straight into it at the cost of our children. And the truth is, this applies to everybody in the entire world. It's a big nisayin for everybody not to give in to social pressure. But for somebody that has a rebellious child, the social pressure on him is a lot greater and a lot more intense. And the nisayin of bowing to social pressure is a lot greater and a lot more intense. And there's something else here too. One of the most common issues that parents have with their rebellious children is the fact that the children bow to social pressure from their peers. Peer pressure to do negative things. And the parents are telling them, don't listen to what this person says, you have to be better than your friends, and so what if they're going to look at you strange? You should stick up, yizgaber kari, you should az kanona, you should be chutzpedik for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and you shouldn't care what anybody says, al yizbayish mibnei hamaligim, don't care about the people that laugh at you. And then this father that has such a great rasha, who refused to walk down the street with his son because of the people that will laugh at him. If that's not the epitome of hypocrisy, I don't know what is. If you want your children to resist social pressure, obviously the first thing you have to do is resist it yourself. If the father makes the decision where he says, no, if I don't walk down the street with my son, it'll be good for him, it'll cause him to come around. Now, theoretically, I guess that could be possible in theory, but that's not the case usually. Usually what happens is that the father knows that it's not good for the child to be rejected like that. But he says, he's embarrassed, he's humiliated, he's ashamed. Which means one thing. The father is bowing down to peer pressure. That's all it is. That's the bottom line. The kid should, no, the kid, not the kid, somebody should give the father the same speech. All of these things. You have to do what's right no matter what other people think. It's peer pressure. That's all it is. Our system, our community has tremendous nisyonos with peer pressure. And it doesn't matter if you're a teenager or an adult or a menahel in the yeshiva or a rosh yeshiva. Everybody has nisyonos because of peer pressure. And I must say at this point that there, I chalila don't mean to cast aspersions on, a blanket aspersions on our menahelim and our yeshivas to say that they all buckle under to peer pressure. I know a number of wonderful mechanchim, wonderful rosh yeshivas, wonderful menahelim that would not do something that's to the detriment of their students, even if it will cause their yeshiva tremendous distress. And those people deserve a medal. And we need more like them. But if we expect our children to do what's right and to snub their nose and to turn their back at their friends that are all doing what's wrong, then we have to do that ourselves. And because of the world we live in, very often we fail that nisayon. So that's what it is. To summarize, in our generation, the Pnei Hador is like the Pnei of the Kelev. The whole communal structure is affected by it. And the nisyonos are many and difficult. If you have a rebellious child, your nisyon in this regard is going to be even greater. And if you want a small chance of being successful, you have to show your children that you're not buckling under to the peer pressure. And that will give him chizuk to be able to stand up straight against his peers. But if he sees that his father and or his mother are weaklings, and they care more about what people say than about what's doing what's right, how do we expect our children to respond? And now at this point I'm going to take questions. I know last week there were a lot of questions, so I'm giving some more time for them now. Henry, if you please collect them. We'll do this one first. What do you do if a child lies or sneaks in order to get what he wants, since he knows you won't approve? He says there is no choice. It is the only way to get what he quote-unquote needs. Quote-unquote and underlined, double. Is it better to just give him these things so that he shouldn't sneak? Okay. This is a perverted cheshbon. It's fakrumpt. But I have to lie because it's the only way for me to get what I want. That's like saying, because you don't want to give me the money in the bank that I'm asking for, the only way for me to get it is by pointing a gun at the teller. So question, maybe we should give him the money anyway so that he shouldn't become a bank robber? The answer is, it doesn't matter if you rob a bank with a gun or if you rob a bank with blackmail. You're still a bank robber. And the fact is, if you give in to your child because you're afraid that he's going to lie, he's still the same problem child as he would be if he would lie or sneak. It's the same thing. It's just blackmail. It's like, if you don't give me what I want, I'm going to do this and this. The first thing is that we have to convey to our children that that attitude is nothing but blackmail, and it doesn't work. It cannot be done. Now, the way to explain it to our children is this. What does he mean he has no choice other than to lie? Lying is not a choice. I remember once I was giving a shiur in Hilchos Shabbos in shul. It was Friday night, and we were going over the halachas of Daleika, halachas of what happens if a fire, chalila, breaks out in somebody's house on Shabbos. Now, al pi din, a person is not allowed to put out that fire if the fire only poses a danger to property. If the fire poses a danger to human life, and usually it does, then of course you can do anything to protect those lives. However, if the fire is only posing a danger to property, you're not allowed to put out that fire. That's the halacha, black and white. Somebody in the audience says, well, what happens if the whole house is going to burn down? No lives are in danger, the whole house is going to burn down. So I say, you have to let the house burn down. So he looks at me and he says, what do you mean? It's your house. It's your house. So I look at him back and I say, but what do you mean? It's Shabbos. What do you mean? It's Chol Shabbos. He's sitting here. How in the world do you have a choice? It's your house. And I'm answering him, you don't. What kind of choice? It's Chol Shabbos. There is no choice. When we say we have no choice, it all depends upon how you look at it, upon your hashkafa. I remember once when I was a little kid, I was a real little kid, and I had this relative, a woman, an Aunt Thelma, her name is. She's not from. I was a little kid. She lived out in Long Island, somewhere about halfway between here and Portugal, somewhere really, really out far. And she came, she used to come to visit. And I was, I think I was 13, 14 years old. I was in 9th grade, maybe 10th grade. And she was trying to, she just didn't understand how frum people live in today's world. And we always used to have, like, discussions, quote unquote. And she says to me, she says, I don't understand, with her Long Island accent. She says, what happens if you meet a nice shiksa and you want to marry her? Then what are you going to do? In other words, how can a frum person survive? You know, like, it just doesn't work. So I said, I don't understand. In such a case, there's no choice. So she says, see, I told you. I says, what do you mean, see, you told me? See, you said you have no choice, which means you'd marry her. And I say, no, that's not what I meant, Aunt Thelma. What I meant was, there's no choice. A shiksa is a shiksa. It's nothing to discuss. So when you say you have no choice, it all depends on your perspective. And when this kid comes to you and says, I have no choice but to lie, or but to sneak, but to steal, because otherwise I'm not getting what I want, that's not a choice. There's no such thing as I have no choice but to lie. Lying isn't a choice. This is what has to be ingrained in his head. You don't have a choice but not to get what you want. That's what you're not forced into lying. You're forced into not getting what you want. Now, of course, if he's holding already by the blackmail, it's probably very late to start knocking this into his head. But knocked into his head, it has to be. And if you didn't begin when he was small, you may as well start now. That's the idea. What do you mean you have no choice? Lying is not a choice. A and B, you're lying, you're stealing anyway by resorting to blackmail. That's what has to be explained to them. But the main thing is that lying is not a choice. It's not an option. Not getting what you want is what you're forced into, not forced into lying. Next question. How can we show disapproval of a child's actions in a way that is not going to be misinterpreted as our concern for our own quote-unquote peer pressure? Don't we have to show disapproval since acceptance is going to be equal to approval? Yeah. Of course you have to show disapproval for a child's bad actions when it's going to help. Now, sometimes, and we're not getting into this now, sometimes, of course, it's better not to do anything. But let's assume now that we're going to show disapproval. Of course we have to show disapproval. But what does that have to do with walking down the street with your arm around your son on Ocean Parkway? Because you disapprove of what he did last night, or you disapprove of what he does in general? Does that mean he's not your son? Does that mean you just shove him away with both hands? Is that even going to, even if you do do that, is that going to be interpreted by him as disapproval of his actions? The question was, how do we show disapproval in a way that won't be interpreted as embarrassment? The answer is, if it is real disapproval and not embarrassment, that's how it's going to be understood. If the friends were not watching, if it wasn't Ocean Parkway, but rather some dark alley, the father would have no problem being seen with the son. Or not being seen, or being in his vicinity. Because it's a public place, all of a sudden he has to show his disapproval for his son's actions. Well, when nobody's looking, he doesn't have to show his disapproval. When everybody's looking, so he has to show his disapproval. What's disapproval? I don't want to walk with you in the street. That's not disapproval. That's embarrassment. The answer is that your children can smell out what your real motives are. They'll smell it out before you do. Sometimes we rationalize, and sometimes we convince ourselves that because we can't approve of their actions, that's why we chalila don't want them to be seen in public. That's absurd. It's not so. Yeah. If you want to tell them that you disapprove of what they're doing, you tell them that you disapprove of what they're doing. You can tell them in no uncertain terms. If you want to mete out punishment, you can mete out punishment. But the fact of the matter is that despite all of the punishment and all of the disapproval, this is your child. I mean, we're not talking about somebody that's menasach yayin. We're not talking about somebody like that. There are different levels, of course. So we're not talking about somebody that's going to do all those things that would really disqualify a child to be in the home or in the family structure. A child will accept disapproval more if it's coming from a loving father. If it's coming from a father that he doesn't think loves him, he won't accept the disapproval. You understand? It's not two conflicting forces. It's not the father's love conflicting with the disapproval. There should not be a conflict over there. One thing has nothing to do with the other. Technically, it's the love of the father that generates the disapproval. If the father wouldn't care, what does he care what the kid does? He doesn't care what his neighbor does. But certainly, it's not a conflict. There's disapproval, there's love. We said the Sephorno says in Parshas Bahaloscha that the only control a father has over a child, the only way a father is able to control a child's actions when they disagree, the only reason the father can do it is because the child knows that the father loves him and means his good. That's what the Sephorno says. It's on the Pesach HaNoichi Harisi Yosam by the Asafsof. That's what it says. Now, if the child doesn't understand that the father loves him, then all your disapproval is wasted. And if you have a shaila, exactly how to do the balance, it's better to err on the side of love, because it's a mistake that's easily corrected, more easily corrected, and does a lot less damage. Of course, disapproval is disapproval. I remember once, about a year ago, we had a reception for Project Rejuvenation where one of the boys spoke. This boy was 17 years old then, and he was from a Hasidish family, and he, at the age 14, decided to join a motorcycle gang. It was an amazing speech. We had a lot of very good professional speakers, but his was the best. And he was a terrible speaker. He got a standing ovation, and there wasn't a dry eye in the audience. And he spoke about his whole story. And he said that the thing that made the biggest impression on him was when somebody disapproved, made it clear that he disapproved, but still treated him like a mensch. He mentioned the story where, and I didn't even know he was going to say this. This kid was very, very heavily involved in guns, all sorts of firearms, and he once lent a gun to a friend of his, also one of the wayward teenagers that we deal with. So the shoyel, the one that borrowed the gun, together with three or four other teenagers, were once caught on 13th Avenue by the police in a stolen car. They were riding around this car for about a month and a half, and they were finally caught. One of them was arrested, some of them ran away. But what happened was that this boy accidentally left the gun under the seat of the car. And he was so scared that they would find it. He snuck into the car, which was parked in the police parking lot, down about 16th Avenue and 59th Street, opened up the door, took the gun out from under the seats, and went home with it. He came home with the gun. It was a big gun. It was big. And his father was a nice fine yid that couldn't really cope with his son's rebelliousness, now sees his son coming home with his big weapon in his hand, and he said, "All right, that's it. Get out." And the son says, "I'm not going." And the father says, "Yes, you are." And they got into a discussion about it, and a heated discussion about it, and an argument and a fight about it, and the father grabbed a chair in a threatening manner. Now this boy had a gun in his hands. And he picked up the gun, he actually did it, and pointed it at his father. The mother called me on the phone. She was afraid, Khalilah, somebody's going to get hurt here. And I called a neighbor of this boy, who we knew, who's helping us out with him. I told him, go over there, bring $400, buy the gun off the kid, do something, just get him away with it, and I'm on my way. I live in Far Rockaway, it's 45 minutes. Akitza, he did it, that's what happened. And he put the gun in his big shoebox, the neighbor, and he said, "Okay, Rabbi Shapiro, I don't want this in my house, you take it." I said, "Fine." I called the police, and I said, "I have a gun. I got it, I took it from a 16-year-old kid. It's illegal. If you want, I'll bring it into you, and you can do with it whatever you like. Or if you want, I'll throw it into the river. You tell me what to do." They said, "Bring it in, just you can't carry it in. You have to wrap it up in a box, because if a guy comes into the police station carrying a gun, they'll think that the guy means to do something with it." So that's what happened. I gave it to them. They took it apart. I saw them unscrew it. They did whatever they did. Fine. Anyway, the kid that owned the gun, remember him, the motorcycle gang, Hasidish guy? He was so angry at me, I heard. People had told me, he's angry, I destroyed his gun. Guns are worth money. Vaisois, and he was so angry at me. And I went over to him, I met him by the next meeting we had, and I asked him how much the gun is worth, and he said about $120. I gave him $120. I said, I took away your gun, I owe you the money. Here's the money. No problem. That was the end of the story. Now at the reception, he's making a speech about his whole life story, and he says that this particular incident made more of an impression on him than anything else that ever happened to him. Positive impression. Because he said until then, everybody either was scared of him and didn't want to say that what he did was wrong, because they're scared. Maybe they're either scared of him or they're scared that it would have a negative effect on him. Or all they did was put him down and treat him like he wasn't even a human being. He said this was the first time that somebody clearly disapproved of his actions, clearly disapproved, yet treated him like a mensch. One hand's makarev, one hand pushes away. One hand gives a slap. Now the truth of the matter is, I took his gun, I destroyed it, so I gave him the money. Does that mean the fact that I gave him the money means I approved of him having it? Absolutely not. Happens to be, it's a very, very complex shaila, pi halacha. If somebody has something that's a davar aser, if you're allowed to just take it away or destroy it. I once asked Rav Elyashiv about this. Rav Elyashiv says if it's not isurei hano, and gun is not isurei hano, even if the person will definitely do aveiros with it, you're not allowed to destroy it. Rav Yisrael Yanke Fisher, I asked also, he said he's not sure. He said it's from the complicated questions. There are a number of tshuvas on it in Svarim, and it's not so simple. But in any case, I gave him the money. I destroyed his gun, I gave him the money. Does that mean I approve of what he did? No. I have an obligation. And he felt that he was a person to whom people have obligations. In the same sentence, the same breath as the disapproval. So, it's really true that if you think of disapproval in terms such that it doesn't contradict the father's love, and it really doesn't. One has nothing to do with the other. Both can be displayed. Very often we're afraid that if we show love, that means approval. It doesn't mean approval. What does love have to do with approval? Think of it this way. How would you like HaKadosh Baruch Hu to treat you? Disapproves of things you do? But he shows you love anyway. Happens to be that the Rambam says that the Rasha is sonui, is hated by Hashem, but that's not for now. The fact is that you can display love and disapproval at the same time if you believe that it's not a contradiction. If you feel that you can only do one or the other, then you're stuck between a rock and a hard place.